Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Statin Therapy Case Challenge, Lipid Treatment Strategies in Patients with HIV, which is certified by Medscape and presented by James A. Underberg, MD, and David D. Waters, MD. Dr. Underberg is a clinical assistant professor of medicine, NYU School of Medicine, and the NYU Langone Center for CV Prevention, Preventive CV Medicine, Lipidology and Hypertension Director, Bellevue Hospital Lipid Clinic, New York, New York. Dr. Underberg has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Genzyme Corporation and LipoScience. He served as a speaker or a member of a speakers bureau for Abbott Laboratories, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Daiichi Sankyo, Eli Lilly and Company, Forest Laboratories, GlaxoSmithKline, Kowa Company, LipoScience, and Merck & Company. Dr. Underberg does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Underberg does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Waters is a professor emeritus, Division of Cardiology, San Francisco General Hospital, University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Waters has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Agerion Pharmaceuticals, Anthera Pharmaceuticals, Biosante Pharmaceuticals, Serenus Therapeutics, CSL Behring, Genentech, Merck & Company, Pfizer, Roche, Sanofi Aventis, Shearing Plough Corporation, and Servier. He served as a speaker or a member of a speakers bureau for Pfizer. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Anthera Pharmaceuticals. Dr. Waters does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Waters does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to provide guidance on statin selection strategies in HIV patients with dyslipidemia in an effort to reduce statin-related drug-drug interactions. This activity is supported by Kowa Company and Eli Lilly and Company. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello. My name is Dr. James Underberg. I'm a clinical assistant professor of medicine at the NYU School of Medicine and the NYU Langone Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention. I specialize in preventive cardiovascular medicine, lipidology, and hypertension, and direct the lipid clinic at Bellevue Hospital in New York City. I would like to welcome you to this panel discussion entitled Statin Therapy Case Challenge, Lipid Treatment Strategies in Patients with HIV. Today, I'm also joined by my colleague, Dr. David Waters, a professor emeritus in the Division of Cardiology at San Francisco General Hospital, the University of California, San Francisco, in San Francisco, California. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Today, we're going to discuss a very interesting topic that for some people seems to be a little confusing, and hopefully we can simplify it for you, and that is the use of statin therapy in patients with HIV/AIDS. Obviously, this is an area where patients are at increased risk for cardiovascular disease, and also the medications, statins in particular, that we use to treat the abnormalities of the lipid panels in these patients often run into issues with their drug-drug interactions. So today we're going to try and focus on some of the drugs that we use and the statins and how they interact with some of the antiretroviral therapy that are typically used in patients with HIV and AIDS. So what are the causes of atherosclerosis in HIV patients? And I think the easiest way to describe this is that they're multifactorial. Certainly, we start with the inflammatory processes of HIV infection itself, viral replication, inflammation, traditional risk factors, dyslipidemia, smoking, obesity, inactivity, hypertension. All of these also contribute very strongly to the process of atherosclerosis in HIV patients. Finally, the last piece of the puzzle is a combination of both endothelial dysfunction, and then the area that we're going to focus on today is the role of antiretroviral therapy, protease inhibitors, some of the newer drugs that are used to manage patients with HIV therapy. All of these can impact the lipid profile, and in some cases may be implicated in the progression of atherosclerosis, so this area is certainly up for debate. And so clearly this multifactorial approach is indicated given the multiple causes for the development of atherosclerosis in HIV patients. When we think about the dyslipidemia in patients with HIV and AIDS, there obviously are a lot of causes here. David, do you want to talk about any of the abnormalities that we typically see in HIV patients?
It's a little bit different than the average patient with coronary disease. Patients with HIV are much more likely to have low HDL. The disease itself causes that because they're more likely smokers, they're more likely to have low HDL. They're more likely to have high triglycerides and features of the metabolic syndrome, partly due to the medications that they take, so that the treatment that we use has to be perhaps tailored a little bit more than the treatment that we use in someone who just has coronary disease.
Absolutely. It's interesting when patients first present with HIV disease, as you were mentioning, typically low HDL, associated with elevated triglycerides, but then as the disease progresses, lower levels of LDL cholesterol seem to develop. That may be associated with the wasting aspects of the disease, or there may be other features, specifically the low HDL, high triglyceride component, pushing that cholesterol into the non-LDL particles, such as VLDL cholesterol. Then what happens with therapy, as we know, is that oftentimes the LDL levels start to improve as patients become more well. Triglyceride levels can remain elevated or can decrease with therapy, but HDL seems to consistently remain low. Patients with low HDL and high triglycerides typically have this condition you were alluding to called atherogenic dyslipidemia. With smaller, dense LDL particles and often increased levels of ApoB or LDL particle number. The next slide just shows some data looking at patients treated with antiretroviral therapy with or without protease inhibitors, and then those that are not treated at all. And you can see here, looking at markers of atherogenic lipoproteins, in this case LDL particle number, more abnormalities with antiretroviral therapy with the protease inhibitor than without, and none with all. So not only does the disease itself cause issues with regards to lipids and lipoproteins, but the therapy can play a role here. If we look at the next slide, which is a breakout of this particular study, total cholesterol remains relatively constant, does go down a little bit with no therapy. LDL cholesterol remains low. LDL particle number is higher than one would expect in these patients. So again, consistent with the typical metabolic syndrome type of patient, correct?
Yes, and I think the bottom line, the simple takeaway message is that the LDL level, even though it may look relatively normal, tends to be very atherogenic LDL. It's the small, dense particles. It's in an environment where atherosclerosis is accelerated because of the high level of inflammatory markers, the endothelial dysfunction, and everything else. So you look at the LDL level on your lab report and you think it's okay, but you should maybe stop and think that maybe it isn't.
And I think one of the things that often confuses people here is that the lipid panel is a dysmetabolic type of lipid panel, yet the patients often don't appear the way we're used to seeing these patients. They're often not obese. They have a wasting syndrome. Mm-hmm. So I think we're not set up to expect the type of lipid abnormalities that we find. Okay. So let's move on to the next slide. I want to talk a little bit about the statins and how we use these in treating HIV-infected patients. Patients with HIV disease are clearly at increased risk for atherosclerosis. We talked about that. Markers of atherosclerosis increase in patients with HIV disease, such as carotid intimal medial thickness, and cardiovascular event rates seem to be greater. We talked about some of the causes there. Targeting their risk with statins, I think, is a key part of the treatment paradigm. In addition to the lipid-lowering effects of statins, there are a variety of other non-lipid or pleiotropic effects that we often talk about, the impact on inflammatory cytokines, T lymphocytes, and acute phase reactant proteins. I think that targeting these patients with statin is important. Our current guidelines suggest statins as the cornerstone of lipid-lowering therapy. We have nice reductions across all of the endpoints that we like to see. And I would guess that that extends to patients with HIV disease, correct?
I think we have to assume that it does. I mean, nobody's ever going to do a 4S study in HIV patients or a heart protection study or something like that. I think we just have to transpose the data we have from primary and secondary prevention in non-HIV patients and assume that it gives us the same results.
So we have a first patient case. Our first patient here, JS, is a 51-year-old Hispanic female. She has a past medical history significant for HIV disease. She also has hyperlipidemia. She's currently being treated with a variety of different antiretroviral therapies, and her LDL cholesterol has been steadily increasing over the past year. Most recently, significantly elevated at 172 milligrams per deciliter. She's also a smoker, and you alluded to that we do see increased smoking rates in this population. Her Framingham risk score, though, I think because of her sex and her age, is still on the lower side. It's 6%. Lifestyle modifications at this time probably would not be adequate to get to her desired LDL goal, which, based on Framingham, would be at least an LDL cholesterol goal of less than 130 milligrams per deciliter. Now, Framingham does give us an option to go a little lower in moderate risk patients. I'm wondering, do you view an HIV positive patient as someone who maybe gets pushed into a higher risk category?
Definitely. I would sort of give them one extra risk factor.
Right.
And I think it's really easy to treat them more aggressively.
Almost like we would with someone who met metabolic syndrome criteria.
Yes, definitely.
And so I think if you were going to argue that this patient deserved an LDL cholesterol goal of, say, 100 milligrams per deciliter, I don't think anyone would argue with that.
Yeah, I think if you're going to treat, if you can treat without causing any side effects, it's good to get the cholesterol as low as possible. If your goal was 160 and you're already at 172, you're not going to reduce risk very much. I think some of the new guidelines in other countries suggest not only that you get to a target, but that you get a certain percent LDL reduction. So in her, if you could get 40 or 50% LDL reduction and below 100, that would probably be better than just below 130.
Now it's interesting. Again, patients with HIV disease often have significantly elevated triglycerides. We don't know her triglyceride level here. We're going to assume it's normal. But in the patients who do, we kind of break it down into those whose triglycerides are greater than 500 and those who have triglyceride elevations between, say, 150 and 499. How would you manage those differently?
I think when triglycerides are above 500, you really have to pay attention to them and treat them specifically and probably use a low-dose fibrate, which is usually very efficacious. You can often, as you know, get by with very low dose and get a lot of triglyceride reduction. Statins themselves reduce triglycerides. The reduction is more when the triglycerides are higher.
Right.
So since we're going to start a statin anyway, we could see what happens to the triglycerides. Triglycerides sort of have an interesting history in the field of lipids. They're a risk factor, but always when you do a multivariate analysis, they sort of drop out and HDL becomes the important one. And I sort of schematically look upon them as if there's a group of kids hanging around on the corner and two or three of them have a criminal record and have been to jail, triglycerides is there, and triglycerides, it's hard to pin a case on it, but it hangs out with the bad guys. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. In one recent meta-analysis of 29 different trials, if your triglycerides were elevated above a certain amount, the relative risk was 1.72. But in other adjusted studies, mm-hmm. that risk seems to disappear yep. when you adjust for HDL yep. and other yep. factors. My thinking on this is that many of these very high triglyceride patients often are familial conditions, mm-hmm. not associated with elevated levels of ApoB or LDL particle mm-hmm. number. I think many of these HIV patients, on the other hand, probably are. Yep. And while it's important to get the triglycerides down first mm-hmm. when they're above 500 to prevent mm-hmm. pancreatitis with either fibrates and or high-dose omega-3s and then sometimes statins, when they're lower, the guidelines, at least in HIV patients here in the United States, seem to focus back on non-HDL,
yes.
correct?
Yes.
Do you use non-HDL as a management tool in these patients?
I think it's a sort of an easy way to take the triglycerides into account without directly attacking them, yes.
I mean, we practice in a large inner city clinic and certainly don't have the option of looking at many of these advanced lipoprotein yep. markers, but non-HDL is free and
right.
it's easy. So I think it's a very useful tool, and once your LDL cholesterol is targeted, the guidelines tell us mm-hmm. to go back mm-hmm. and look at non-HDL
right.
cholesterol. And
yep.
again, targeting those patients with statins is really the recommended treatment approach to patients such as this. So the question here is which statin would be the most efficacious in achieving goal LDL cholesterol and also at the same time trying to avoid some of the DDIs or drug-drug interactions that people are so concerned about in patients on a variety of different antiretroviral therapies. So what's your traditional approach when you have these patients referred to you?
Yeah, I think the first thing, sort of the major thing, is to avoid simvastatin. I mean, it really has the most drug-drug interactions. It's really the most myopathic of all the statins. You should probably never use 80 milligrams, even in patients who don't have HIV. So that really, if you just want to follow one rule, that would be the first one. After that, I tend to avoid, and this is just my personal opinion, little statins, pravastatin, fluvastatin, they're safe, you get some LDL reduction, but I would like to have a little bit more than that. Rosuvastatin, atorvastatin, pitavastatin, you get more LDL reduction. I personally tend to use atorvastatin, but that's just a personal quirk. Mm-hmm. I think whichever statin you pick, as you know, probably start at a lower dose. I don't think you have to memorize 483 drug-drug interactions with all the HIV drugs, but look out for other drugs that interfere with the hepatic enzyme system, fibrates particularly, with statins, with the HIV drugs. Even calcium channel blockers have a little effect, digoxin, warfarin, amiodarone. But starting at a low dose, I think, and seeing what happens is really pretty safe.
Yeah, I think we agree on that approach. And again, it's very difficult for everyone to keep track of mm-hmm. all of the potential DDIs. The use of electronic mm-hmm. medical records certainly helps us a little bit, but oftentimes it will prompt us to something that may not necessarily be a clinically significant
right.
interaction.
Yes.
And the indications for these medications are changing all the time as pharmacokinetic studies are being mm-hmm. done as the newer drugs mm-hmm. come out. And many times the drug is contraindicated simply because no one has looked at the mm-hmm. safety, and it's not that safety
right.
is
yes.
actually an issue. So like yourself, we tend to use drugs ideally that don't have their primary metabolism through the cytochrome P450-3A4 pathway. The exception would be atorvastatin, because even lower doses of atorvastatin have a fairly potent reduction mm-hmm. in LDL cholesterol. Rosuvastatin, again, and pravastatin are minimally metabolized through the cytochrome P450 system. Pitavastatin has most of its metabolism through a glucuronidation pathway, mm-hmm. And so has minimal interaction mm-hmm. with most of these drugs that are otherwise metabolized through the more traditional pathways. So I think there are some options that one can use here, and remembering the fact that many of these patients have significant excursions not only in LDL but also non-HDL or mm-hmm. ApoB or LDL particle number, ultimately avoiding those less potent statins is probably the way to go, because you do have a fair mm-hmm. amount of reduction required. The other side of the coin is that you are going to probably need to do combination mm-hmm. therapy in mm-hmm. many of these patients who also have high triglycerides. So our preferred fibrate is fenofibrate. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't increase the Cmax of any of the statins, whereas gemfibrozil, which certainly is available in a generic form, often interacts and increases the Cmax and the half-life of many of these other statins, fluvastatin really being the only one it doesn't interact with significantly, but fluvastatin is one of the more mildly potent statins. So we have a group of different drugs to move forward with. This is just a schematic that goes over again. The 3A4s are simvastatin, which I think we both agree one should avoid. Lovastatin, not very potent, and so we're not using it as much anymore. It is available generically. And then the atorvastatin, certainly starting at lower doses. Fluvastatin, again, not that potent. Pitavastatin, at its highest dose, will lower LDL cholesterol about 45%. Mm-hmm. So I think of it as a moderate potency statin, and then rosuvastatin, actually our most potent statin right now. Glucuronidation is mostly pravastatin and pitavastatin. So I think understanding how these statins kind of shake out helps us make these decisions. So here is just a kind of review of some of the things we talked about. I think one of the things we haven't touched on is what drives some of these statin-related side effects. And the one that we're obviously most concerned about is the rhabdomyolysis. And one of the things I always remind people is that rhabdomyolysis can happen with any statin at any dose. And it doesn't necessarily mean that because a statin is hydrophilic or hydrophobic or 3A4 or non-3A4, it's an issue. But what's becoming more of an issue are how these drugs are transported in and out of cells, these organic anion transport proteins. So what's been your experience with rhabdomyolysis and statins? Are you seeing it commonly, not commonly, in these HIV patients?
I think overall rhabdomyolysis is extremely rare. And an average physician practicing in a regular practice probably has a greater chance of winning the lottery, even if he doesn't buy a ticket, than causing rhabdomyolysis. In HIV patients, it's more common. It's obviously more common in patients who take other drugs metabolized by the same system. I practiced for a long, long time, and I have actually only had one of my own patients that developed rhabdomyolysis, and that was because a physician out in the community switched his statin to simvastatin, and within a few weeks he got severe rhabdomyolysis. He was also on a fibrate and HIV drugs, and that's the only case I've seen. So in my experience, simvastatin is really the one that is the bad guy, likely to be the bad guy.
So between the two of us, we've seen three patients. I always remind people that risk factors for rhabdomyolysis include polypharmacy, liver disease, kidney disease, which you can see in this population, frail body habitus, which is another one, female sex, and then increasing age. Again, just looking out for those factors, untreated hypothyroidism also, I think are ways that you can minimize some of the risks of this problem. So when we look at co-administration of statins with some of the protease inhibitors, this is just an overview slide. Again, we've both reiterated the fact that to understand all of the details of all of these drugs is difficult for anyone. We both practice in institutions where there is a significant number of HIV-positive patients, so we're seeing these patients all the time. And the one thing I always say is I never ask the infectious disease doctors to change medications. And when you have abnormalities in the lipid profile that are potentially made worse by these HIV medications, good data now suggests that if you change the antiretroviral therapy, you're at greater risk of worsening the viral load from the patient than just simply going and implementing more aggressive cholesterol-lowering therapy, correct?
Yes. One of the interesting features of HIV disease is if you stop the medication and give it intermittently and the viral load gets a chance to spike, that actually has been shown to increase cardiovascular events. So you don't want to do that. On the other hand, there are newer drugs coming out that are probably less atherogenic and cause less lipid abnormalities in the HIV field. I never tell them that they should change their drugs, but I sometimes say, can't you find a better drug regimen, and if they stop and think about it, they sometimes can.
Great. So I think we've discussed what the potential options are with this patient, and there are several drugs that would potentially be reasonable ones to start with, again, understanding the parameters that we've talked about. So why don't we go on to the next patient case now, which is someone who's presents a little differently. And
yes, this is a patient that came to our clinic at San Francisco General Hospital, and we actually have a special clinic in cardiology for patients with HIV disease because we have such a big HIV population. This is a 50-year-old man with HIV infection, a CD4 count of 280, a viral load of 50,000, who's treated with three different HIV drugs. From a cardiac perspective, his blood pressure is just a little bit high. He's a cigarette smoker, as about 60% of our patients are. His HDL is a little bit low. His triglycerides are high. His LDL cholesterol is 190. His total cholesterol is 260, and his non-HDL cholesterol is 225. And his BMI is just at the borderline between overweight and obese. And he comes to cardiology because he's been getting increasing shortness of breath on exertion that could not be explained in any other way. So his resting electrocardiogram shown here is pretty normal. And the first test that we did on him was a regular ECG stress exercise test. And on this slide, the first complex you see is his resting complex. And the second complex is after 3 minutes of exercise when he became quite short of breath. And you can see that there's marked horizontal ST depression in lead 2, 3, AVF, and over in the lateral leads, V3 to V6, probably up to 5 millimeters of ST depression in V4. So this is a very high-risk stress exercise test. The patient underwent a coronary angiogram. And you can see here, at least you can see part of it, he's got significant three-vessel disease. It's a little bit hard to see his LAD here in this projection, but he had significant stenosis in his LAD circumflex, and you can see his right coronary artery fills distally. So he went to coronary bypass surgery, and I think the point of this case is that really he didn't have many symptoms, just dyspnea, which might not have been cardiac in origin. He was relatively young. He was in his early 50s, but he'd already developed a severe coronary atherosclerosis. So I think we really have to be ready to investigate these patients and think about coronary disease just like we would in someone with multiple risk factors without HIV.
So presenting maybe in less common scenarios,
yes,
is something that we need to be worried about. Now, this patient, typically, if they were not an HIV patient, they come back from the cath lab at my institution, they're on 80 milligrams of atorvastatin. Would that be the case?
Not 80 milligrams, and maybe not atorvastatin.
Right.
If he didn't have HIV, he's got coronary disease, he's young, the guidelines say treat his LDL to less than 100. With the option to treat him to less than 70 because he's a cigarette smoker and
right,
got high risk. Obviously, you try and get him to quit smoking and deal with his slightly elevated blood pressure and do those other things. But I think you'd want to be very aggressive with his LDL, and
right,
I'm sure you would be too. I mean, he's at 190, I think it was, and cutting that in half would be very good. So I think rosuvastatin, pitavastatin, or atorvastatin, and we wouldn't start with 80 milligrams or 40 milligrams or the highest dose
right
of pitavastatin, but we would want to get up there relatively quickly. One of the things that we've looked at in our relatively small population is what happens to people with HIV who get bypass surgery or PCI. And there's some evidence that because of their continuing low level of inflammation that they may end up coming back with recurrent symptoms more quickly than someone without HIV. And we know that the statins are also anti-inflammatory, so there's theoretical reasons to suggest that they may have benefit besides their LDL lowering.
So early and aggressive therapy, I think,
yes,
is key here, and doing it in a safe way.
Yes.
So I think at this point, I'm going to wrap up. I think it's important to remember that patients with HIV disease are at increased risk for atherosclerosis, coronary heart disease, and multifactorial interventions for a process that is caused by multiple risk factors, I think is the appropriate way to manage these patients. The dyslipidemia that is seen in patients with HIV disease comes from many different factors. There are abnormalities in enzymes such as a cholesterol ester transfer protein and proteins such as the ABCA1 transporter that are involved in lowering HDL cholesterol levels and increasing the number of these small dense LDL particle numbers and raising triglycerides. Along with the other risk factors, they need to be addressed aggressively and safely. And doing that with statin therapy in the context of how those drugs interact with the variety of other antiretroviral therapies that these patients are on is the key, I think, to effective and safe management of patients with this condition. So, David, I want to thank you for this excellent discussion, and I want to thank our audience also for tuning in. Every time I review this topic with someone who comes to it from a slightly different perspective than I do, I always learn something new, and I think our audience has too. So it's really been great chatting with you about this. Thanks a lot.
It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity, Statin Therapy Case Challenge, Lipid Treatment Strategies in Patients with HIV. To participate in the CME Activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.